Is that Adorno in your avatar?
Yeah, that's Adorno.
Nice. I didn't think you looked like that.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Justin Murphy is a lecturer in political science, a participant in the anti-fascist movement, and an occasional practitioner of black bloc tactics. In this episode, we discuss some of the uses and some of the limitations of the black bloc. It's Wednesday, April 12th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. This episode of the Zero Books podcast is part one of two parts. If you'd like to hear the second half, think about joining the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast entitled Inside Zero Books, which sometimes consists of unedited or full-length interviews from the Zero Squared podcast, sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers about the state of the left, and sometimes features public lectures from Zero Books authors or staff. Zero Books members are also invited to participate in YouTube workshops with Zero Books authors and others. Also, you should take a moment to stop by the Zero Books website, that's zero-books.net, and maybe purchase a book on critical theory. You might pick up Uncertain Futures, or Alfie Bound's interview with Sreka Horvat, or a copy of the late Mark Fisher's book, Capitalist Realism. Right now, you're listening to the Infernal Noise Brigade, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Justin Murphy and I discuss the Black Bloc. I'm recording now. Why don't we just chat and see where it goes?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So why don't you start by saying, you know, who you are and what your experience is?
I am a political scientist by vocation, but my experience in politics has been sort of a different source of knowledge, I guess you could say. And I've actually only been involved in radical politics since the days of Occupy Wall Street in the U.S. I was sort of one of the many people who got really radicalized around 2011 from, you know, a lifetime before that of not really being actively engaged in radical politics. So, you know, I'm not one of these people like you see in Britain who's, you know, parents and grandparents and grandparents were, you know, members of the Labour Party or the Socialist Party or whatever it might be. So I got really radicalized in Occupy Wall Street. In Occupy Wall Street, got kind of radicalized in a particular strand, I guess you could say, of sort of ultra-left anarchist communist politics.
Well, let's talk about Occupy Wall Street for a moment. When you got involved with Occupy Wall Street, did you do that in New York? Were you part of?
No, I'm sorry. I just say Occupy Wall Street as a sort of generic label. I was in Philadelphia at that time, so it was Occupy Philly.
Okay. And would you characterize the people or the group that you were involved with or Occupy itself as an anarchist, primarily anarchist movement? Was that did you start out as an anarchist on the left?
Oh, I don't know. You could have all kinds of debates about what Occupy was like, and people have had those debates. I sort of started off as nothing. Right. I was vaguely sort of interested in politics. I was studying politics at the time, but I was not. I always thought sort of activists were losers.
And so what made you change your mind and get involved with Occupy Philly?
Well, I definitely thought that contemporary society was fucked up and needed to be changed massively. But I just thought for most of my life up until then, all of the currently available sort of activist projects were dumb and lame, and I just wasn't interested in them. When Occupy happened, there's like thousands of people in your town, like in the middle of the street taking shit over. Now that was something I could get down with.
When you were involved with Occupy, what appealed to you about it was the fact that it was direct action. Is that right? Would you agree with that?
Sure, in a sense, but I think a little bit more that it was this sort of massive public cultural insurrectionary moment,
right?
Which I think is something a little bit more than direct action. It's consistent with what you're saying about direct action. Of course, there was an appeal to that for me, but it was this idea of a sort of rupture that was sort of publicly performed in a militant way by a large number of people. And that is something that actually does have a lot in common with, I think, the tactics of militant anti-fascism today, in particular Black Bloc and things of this nature. Yeah. That's something that I'm very interested in personally, is sort of how to perform militance in a collective, autonomous way that in turn sort of energizes and inspires others to take up that militance.
There's this idea of propaganda of the deed and a certain kind of direct action, which is more symbolic than truly active. And when you have enough people behind you, when there's a mass movement and a rupture, as you say, then there's a chance for true direct action where you start to collectively reorganize society. And there was a feeling, I mean, I had it too, that Occupy was a start of some kind of movement to truly actually at least attempt to do that. But so let me just ask you this. Did you become an anarchist through Occupy? Do you consider yourself to be an anarchist?
Oh, well, you know, like many revolutionaries, I rebel against the oppression of labels, of course.
Right, right.
So, yeah. I'm unfortunately one of those people who not really too interested in any of these labels. I kind of will play with different labels depending on the audience, because I'm very interested in cultural politics. And I think that the way different words are deployed in different times and places have totally different effects on different types of people, especially today when people are sort of cooped up in their own very distinct, separated sort of symbolic chambers.
My own experience, I came to my politics a while ago in a different time, but when I became more leftist, what I found most compelling and what was the most acceptable for me to embrace was some kind of anarchism as a U.S. far left type, somebody who wanted to see society radically change and who wanted to see capitalism end. I found that the only ideology I might be able to embrace was some sort of anarchism, because Marxism was so polluted and debased by the history of 20th century really existing socialism that I just saw Marxism as another authoritarian strand of statism, basically. And so for a long time, I was some sort of anarchist, ranging from, you know, basically just a liberal to some sort of communist anarchist. Always trying to work it out as to where I stood. There was a moment where I was sort of infatuated with green anarchism. But it was, all of it, around central doctrines of, you know, eliminate a hierarchical, authority, get rid of the state, get rid of capitalism, return to a more organic, set of relations and way of organizing, the world. And it was only after, for me, the economic crisis that I started to reexamine some of my core assumptions and came to be something of a wannabe Marxist, is what I would call myself now. I'm only offering you my labels, maybe just to give you an understanding of why I'm asking the question. I'm not asking the question to try to pin you down, but in order to try to understand what sorts of influences there are, not only in your life, but in anti-fascist movements. So I'll ask a different question. Do you think that there are as many people who would hold with some sort of Marxism involved with anti-fascist movements, as there are people who would hold with some sorts of combinations of anarchist thought involved in anti-fascist movements.
What is the sort of the ideological breakdown of anti-fascism? And it's obviously a very difficult question, which we would need, you know, I'm also a social scientist, right? So I'm aware that we would need proper sort of survey methods to have any hope of a, you know, decently accurate answer to this sort of question. And of course, I don't have that on hand, and I don't think it exists. I mean, there's lots of survey data about protesters for sure, but I don't believe we have very good research on what anti-fascists in particular think, especially militant anti-fascists, for the obvious reason that they tend to be very into secrecy and, you know, not, you know, talking. So I think the honest short answer, which is unsatisfying, is that exactly what is the ideological breakdown of sort of the anti-fascist community, that's something that is very unclear. So with that as a caveat, I can sort of share with you my observations and, you know, the anecdotal data that I do have. I think there's probably a lot of diversity. And I think that would be one of the messages I want to kind of give you today as we talk about these things, is that impressions of militant anti-fascism, especially people who are interested in tactics such as Black Bloc, there is this sort of conventional wisdom that militant anti-fascists must be all a bunch of anti-civilization, nihilist, anarchists, anti-capitalists who just want to destroy everything. I think it's fair to say that that's kind of a, without strawmanning it too bad, I think it's fair to say that that's kind of a popular specter in the public imagination. And I think we can say quite confidently, even though I only have my own experiences and some anecdotal data, I think we can say quite confidently that that is basically not the case. No doubt there are certainly some, you know, anti-civilization, nihilistic types in militant anti-fascism, no doubt. And I'm not disavowing them. Maybe they're my comrades. But there's way more diversity than you know, the contemporary media spectacle would allow you to believe. So, I mean, a lot of people that you would think of as normal people who might not even have that explicitly revolutionary of politics will occasionally block up and fight fascists in the street if that's what they think is the right thing to do. I think there's a fair number of people who engage in tactics such as Black Bloc who are some of them are Marxists, some of them are anarchists, some of them are not even necessarily revolutionaries. Some of them might be more liberal in their political outlook. But what comes together in militant anti-fascism is the shared agreement that when violent, fascist sort of street gangs are entering your community, you get together with your mates and you stop them physically. So that's the only real ideological core of militant anti-fascism. And within that, I think there's a lot of ideological diversity that you wouldn't really, expect to find based on the way that it's reported in the media.
Yeah. So, you know, when I worked in activism, I worked for an organization called the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, which was just a lobbying organization, nonprofit, that tried to get consumer protection and environmental legislation passed through, the state level. And but if you had asked, what is the ideology of the organization? Like, what do people who are part of the organization believe? It tended to be the people in the organization, certainly the people in the canvas, tended to be either much further to the left than the organization, either Marxist or anarchist of some kind, or more apolitical than the organization. But what our personal beliefs were really didn't define what the ideology of the organization was, right? Because the ideology of the organization had its own institutional ideology, which was basically milquetoast liberal reformism. And would you say something similar is true? Not that it's milquetoast liberal reformism at all in the anti-fascist organizations, but that anti-fascist organizations, regardless of their individual members' beliefs, have their own or has its own kind of ideology that's being acted out?
Possibly. I think the distinction with respect to what you're describing is that what we're in this conversation calling militant anti-fascism is a much more diffuse phenomenon, right? It's a sort of general idea or a general culture that people take up in different ways in different times and places with their own style and their own sort of ideological inflections. But I mean, actually, what's sort of interesting about militant anti-fascism is of all of the sort of radical political cultures and activities that one can sort of find today and potentially join or participate in some sense, it's actually one of the least ideologically centered, in the sense that you don't really need to pass many ideological litmus tests to join a militant anti-fascist counter demonstration. You kind of just show up, and if you're down to resist the fascists, you're good to join in for the most part. It's a very sort of practical. It's a very, very practical, goal-oriented type of project when it arises. It's, you know, it's because it's often specifically organized around, there are these bad people coming into this community. How can we all get together to physically resist them if necessary? And so it's kind of like in a lot of the militant anti-fascist groups, at least that I'm familiar with. And again, I can only talk about my own experiences. I'm certainly not speaking for anyone else. But from what I can sense from the different sort of groups I've participated in and been a part of, militant anti-fascism is little more than the sort of shared commitment to doing what it takes to push out the fash where you find them.
It seemed to me that one of the debates that's going on the left right now is what are the best tactics to use in as we face the alt-right, which we might as well just call the fascists. With these anti-fascist organizations, you know, as diffuse as they are and as ideologically diverse as they are, or the members are, they do seem to – they cohere around a set of practical actions, a set of tactics, right? So – if you want to debate what are the right sets of what kinds of tactics, would being involved in an anti-fascist organization limit your ability to question or be skeptical of certain sets of tactics? In other words, have you already made an assumption when you get involved in an anti-fascist organization, if it is centered on tactics, that these are the best tactics? Or is there a diversity of tactics within anti-fascist groups?
There's certainly ideological and tactical divisions within sort of anti-fascist culture, and or if you want to call it an anti-fascist movement. Yeah, no doubt. There's sort of a well-known division in particular between sort of what some people would sort of pejoratively call sort of the soft or fluffy anti-fascist wings and then the militant anti-fascist wings. And that's basically just the distinction between those people who are willing to engage in physical resistance and perhaps against the police also, and those who are opposed to that sort of posture in principle. So yeah, there's a massive division between those two camps. But often when fascists, you know, threaten to show up somewhere, the liberal fascists and the militant anti-fascists will sort of try to do some sort of shared counter demonstration. And then it usually turns to some sort of bickering, or just like the militants go off and try to be militant and the liberals stay put and try to, yell at them to not be so mean or nasty. So that's a sort of a well-known and kind of large cleavage in the anti-fascist culture. But something I did want to go back to what you said was you were talking about how you, for all intents and purposes, sort of used the term alt-right kind of interchangeably with fascist. And I think that that's very interesting. I think that that's something we could definitely have a little discussion or debate about, because I think that that's very far from obvious. And I think that one of the really tricky issues that we're seeing today is that this thing that people call the alt-right contains a variety of different types of figures, actors, thinkers, and just sort of people who actually have very different politics, different cultural politics, different ideologies. And I think that actually serious problems start to arise if you kind of just assume that they're all fascists. And because therefore, if you assume that they're all fascists, that assumes that sort of the typical toolbox of anti-fascism should just be straightforwardly applied to them. And I think that that is actually a major mistake. And I think that's why you're seeing certain kind of ridiculous absurdities in contemporary and sort of what appear to be manifestations of militant anti-fascism, such as, you know, the black bloc that you saw at the Berkeley protests doing, you know, really kind of terribly idiotic things, like, you know, the spray painting of that poor girl who was wearing a hat that said "Make Bitcoin Great Again."
It was pepper spray, right?
So I think,
on her, not,
I think
not,
the,
not
the paint, reason
it was,
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say paint? Yeah. I might have misspoke. Yeah, pepper spray or mace, I might have said. So I think that the reason you're seeing those sorts of things today that appear to be really sort of odd, ideologically scrambled applications of certain tactics that I think baffle and horrify most people, including people on the radical left. I mean, I'm all for militants. Absolutely. I mean, I believe in a diversity of tactics, and I would never, you know, try to police anyone's militancy. I'm actually quite all for it, and may or may not have engaged in different types of behavior myself in different times and places. So this is not sort of, I'm not being a liberal in saying that some of the militants that you're seeing today is a kind of idiotically applied interpretation, I think, of tactics to targets that aren't exactly what people might assume them to be.
Would you say that any white supremacist is a fascist, like Richard Spencer, for instance?
Right. So this is a really good question. And in some sense, it's one of the key questions of contemporary sort of anti-fascism, right? How do you distinguish all of these different types of obviously nasty, villainous characters in sort of the weird internet world and the world more generally? Who counts as proper fascists that should be beaten up, and who counts as not proper fascists who shouldn't be beaten up? That's a really, really difficult question. And I think I've thought a lot about this in my own, you know, experiences with anti-fascism, and also just sort of in my research and reflecting on these issues. And the view that I have come to is that basically I think militant anti-fascism, in particular, you know, all the trappings of physical resistance, things like we think of like Black Bloc, and, you know, all the ways that people come together to protect themselves and to do what they do, to do what they need to do to physically resist fascists. I think that approach is appropriate as a form of community self-defense against organized violent street movements. So I think that's sort of the best definition or criterion that I have been able to come to. And so basically, what does that mean? Well, all that really means is, you know, in easy cases, like if Nazis or neo-Nazis are planning a public march in your town and they're basically preaching violence, or there's a high probability that they're going to be engaging in violence, like running around the streets drunk, you know, yelling racial slurs at people or beating people up, which is something that, you know, neo-Nazi type groups are known to do. If these types of people are coming into your community, yeah, I do think that ethically and politically, it's necessary and justified to do what you have to do to physically prevent them from doing that. I support that. But I think so is the question about what do you do with people like Richard Spencer, or what do you do with all different types of other people who may very well have fascist ideas, but they're not engaging in overt violence. They're not actively entering people's communities or trying to, you know, inflict violence on people in that sort of way. Perhaps, you know, what you're seeing today is like vague sort of internet groups or possibly some protest sort of, you know, public presences, but they're very smart nowadays to not, you know, say anything that's too bad or too violent, although we all sort of know that they're kind of thinking it. I think that this presents a very serious puzzle and challenge. And I don't pretend to have sort of the final word on this. Like I've solved the puzzle. I think we need to have like really interesting and difficult debates about how the radical left and anti-fascists can best combat this sort of new wave of what they call the alt-right groups and individuals. But my instincts are, and well, not just instincts, but my sort of considered reflections are that I think right now there is a tendency to sort of apply the whole sort of basket of tools and vocabularies sort of in the militant anti-fascist tradition to these people, such as Richard Spencer, which I think it's failing. I'm not morally or ethically condemning it necessarily, like the liberal who says like, oh, you know, let's all just get along. Don't be so nasty to Richard Spencer. That's not at all what I'm saying. But I'm interested in what works, and I'm interested in what is going to actually rid the world of fascism. And I look around, and if you look at events such as the Berkeley protests, where you had sort of people using black bloc tactics and different types of very militant behavior to try to stop a Milo from speaking at an event. To me, that's a pretty good illustration of people who have a hammer, and so everything looks like a nail. Right. It's people who know that there's a thing where you can sort of get into black bloc and you can beat people up and spray people with pepper spray. And, you know, we have these sort of repertoires. Right. But people are kind of applying them in an automatic way that I think not only doesn't work, but here's the real kicker, Doug. It's that it's exactly and precisely what the fascists are trying to induce from the radical left. And, you know, I mean, if you look at people like Milo has been extremely explicit about this, that, you know, his whole sort of plan, his whole sort of rise to power was predicated on the very idea of provoking liberals to overreact and to treat him like a violent thug, when in fact he's just sort of saying that crazy shit that he thinks, which we may or may not like, we may or may not find offensive. But he's certainly not a violent street thug engaged in any kind of organized violence. And so I think people like Milo and people on the radical right have learned that actually the radical left and militant Antifa today does have a problem with sort of a little bit too quickly and uncritically using the repertoire of actions that it knows how to use all too quickly in a way that actually propels the alt-right into power. So that's a bit of a long answer.
No, that's a really interesting answer. And I agree with what your conclusion was. And I'm a little disappointed that you and I are agreeing, because I was hoping that I would get someone on who was going to be anti-fascist, and try to represent the movement that I see on television or on more likely on YouTube. I want to take something you said before and examine it a little bit, because I think what you told me was probably the best and most coherent argument for anti-fascist tactics that I've heard. And maybe I've heard it before, but I recognized immediately that it seemed very reasonable and defensible, and which is that, let's say, again, just go to your example, that the Ku Klux Klan or a Nazi organization is planning to march through your Jewish neighborhood. And in the past, when these marches have gone on, you know, completely unopposed and just been sort of people look the other way, what's happened is that, well, great many Nazis show up. They do their march, then they do, some of them get drunk and or emboldened, and violent things happen, whether it's just swearing at people or actual acts of violence. So as a community, as an organizer, you want to control your space, and you want to make sure that those kinds of things don't happen, and you want to make sure that the Nazis or the Klansmen are not emboldened. So you organize an anti-fascist presence and resistance to them. All that seems really logical to me. The only questions that come up, and then maybe I'm taking a liberal position here, is this one. How do you make sure that the people who are there to protect the community are accountable to the community, and that that's the main thing, I think, and that the standards of law in a liberal society aren't violated, or are we justified to violate those standards? In other words, at the very least, there's a possibility of vigilante justice in those situations. And it seemed to me that on the one hand, we can all see as radical leftists that bourgeois justice is no justice at all, or at least not adequate to our vision of what justice would be. On the other hand, it's the only functioning version of justice where there's actual accountability, as bad as it is. And so I just wonder, what are the arguments around that kind of question? And, you know, whether or not you can justify vigilante justice or vigilante violence, and how you make sure that your anti-fascist ground troops basically are themselves accountable to the communities you're supposed to serve.
Right. So that's a very good question. I think that for revolutionaries, ultimately one of the most important forms of accountability that we have is relationships. In some sense, you know, solidarity and relationships and community, that is a source of accountability. And so I think what you see in a lot of radical groups, and I think you do see this in militant anti-fascist street politics, is that there are certain sort of norms or conventions about what it's appropriate to do and not do. Yeah, those are not necessarily the same as those indicated by the law, but there are still sort of community guidelines, if you will, I think. And when people do things that are really unwise or ethically reprehensible, I think that, you know, there is a way in which people who have relationships with each other in the long run can kind of rein each other in. That's one. I mean, that's one possible answer. And it's often not a satisfying one, but it is perhaps, you know, one of the only answers we have ultimately for those of us who believe that the law does not define that. If you believe that the law does not define morality, and that sometimes there are grave threats to ourselves and to our communities that require conscientious action that is perhaps not sanctioned or, you know, protected by the law, but which is necessary and which runs the risk of different types of excess that even the community would not like or desire. The only way you can really rein that in over time and try to keep each other sane is through relationships. So that's one answer, through sort of community norms. But the other answer is, I think with a lot of these sort of difficult questions around revolutionary politics, a lot of it boils down to conscience. I mean, I think that ultimately people have to do what they believe they have to do. And yeah, I think to the liberal conscience, that's not very satisfying, because we, you know, as Western liberals, we want to have control over everything. We want to have mechanisms whereby the community can ensure that bad things don't happen. But I think that that is kind of a delusion of sort of the Western mind, if, in some sense. And that ultimately, what it means to be radical or revolutionary is that you're going to do what you believe you need to do. And you're going, but, and I think this is the key point, you're going to be reflective and honest with yourself and with those around you that you're working with, to not exceed, you know, certain thresholds that is effectively defined dynamically by the people around you who you love and trust. I mean, that's, that might sound abstract, but I think that that's at least the raw materials for a kind of theory of autonomous community accountability that I think about.
Well, the what I hear there, and the last thing you said, is that anti-fascist organizations wouldn't be able to organize large numbers for violent action. Because everything's staying on the level of personal relationships, which basically I would think of as being kind of tribal or on the level of a small tribe. You just can't have, you know, an anti-fascist army of 10,000 where there's love and trust and relationships between all the soldiers.
Sure. But you can put together a group of people who say that Nazis are not going to march in our town.
And right. No, it would work for the small town Nazi rally.
Okay.
But it wouldn't work on, it doesn't scale. That's just something I'm kind of noticing. So,
but possibly. Okay. Good.
That's one of the reasons why it must be really important for anti-fascists not to become institutions, because when people have are parts of institutions, the institutional demands, the organization itself places demands on people beyond the level of personal relationships. And so you have something like, say, for instance, SWP, where they were trying to come up with their own standards of justice around a rape case, and, you know, basing it all on solidarity and camaraderie and personal relationships, really, with some institutional mechanisms in place. And that seemed to be a big failure. They weren't able to – those personal relationships, along with the institutional demands and structures that, you know, were far looser than, say, the liberal bourgeois legal system, allowed for a rape to be covered up for some time. And sure. So there are issues there. But anyway, I'll just let you respond to my blather if you have anything
to say. Yeah, for sure. I think that's all well said. I mean, I think that militant anti-fascism can certainly be scaled in the sense that there are, you know, large umbrella organizations of militant anti-fascists. So in the UK, right, it's the AFN, which I'm, as a member of Southampton Anti-Fascists, I am nominally a member of the AFN. I believe I'm not active in sort of that national organization, but
right.
As far as I know, it's a healthy, functioning, large organization of militants who do, you know, have their institutional shit together, so to speak, and it is organized and it is fairly large scale. And there are many, many sort of local chapters under this national umbrella. So, you know, militancy is not inconsistent with scaling. But your point is well taken that, yeah, I guess the difficulties of drawing limits around what is allowed and what is not allowed, the difficulties with that.
The difficulties of power and accountability is what I would, how I would put it. It's like, you know, if you're going to be accountable to your friends and to your neighbors based on true feelings of solidarity and love and connection, that's not going to happen between people who are living in different states and only know each other through an institution.
Yes, for sure. But I do think that large scale revolutionary organizations can make choices about what type of accountability they see themselves as responsible for and not. Right. So the case of the SWP that you cited, that was a problem of a large scale organization trying or, you know, pretending to be accountable when in fact it wasn't, so that it was effectively like cover ups. So that's horrible. Right. But another path would be that large scale revolutionary organizations understand with humility that they can't control what members do. And so they therefore plan to transparently not overpromise, and therefore never engage in anything that would look like cover up or brushing under the rug things that it's nominally supposed to be accountable for. So that I think is possibly probably the path forward. I think personally, I'm just sort of going off the cuff here. I think that for large scale revolutionary organization, what has to happen is that pretensions to collective centralized accountability have to be radically decreased, which is somewhat unsatisfying. But at least if you're honest about that, then you can avoid problems where, you know, some sort of institutional review board is not, you know, fucking up really badly.
Yeah. So if you're involved in an anti-fascist organization and one of the other anti-fascists rapes you, you're not to go – you shouldn't expect that the anti-fascist institution is going to litigate that.
That
either you're going to have to take care of it on a personal level or you're going to go to the state.
I think that might be the case. I think that people have a very hard time with this because people really want organizations to be able to promise that they're going to prevent bad things from happening. And if bad things happen, they're going to – punish them fully or effectively. People really, really have that sort of deep desire for that. But I think we have to just be honest about what large groups of people as an institution can do to each other and not do to each other humanely in a way that's radical and consistent with large-scale revolutionary social transformation. So this is not in any way saying that, you know, violent, like interpersonal violence within organizations is not a priority or that should be, you know, put to the side or we shouldn't think about that as much. Not at all. I'm not saying anything to that effect. All I'm saying is that, in fact, I'm saying we should take it all the more seriously. All of these different types of interpersonal violence that you do observe in organizations, we should take it so seriously as a part of the fabric of everyday life that we as people interacting with each other have to be constantly on guard against and mutually accountable with respect to in a lived everyday relationship based way, and that you can't create a board or a committee attached to a large scale organization that is somehow going to be able to ensure that those things don't happen or that they're treated, in a certain way if they do happen. I think that when it's that very desire to have a sort of, you know, executive centralized board that prevents bad things from happening or punishes them appropriately, it's that very desire that is I think the very sick and twisted kind of conservative Western control mentality fucks things up and leads to all of these nasty things that you see with, you know, the failures of that approach. Whereas I think if we're just radically honest about the fact that it's unsatisfying, I know, and it's unsettling, I know. But the ultimate fact is that the only real accountability we have as revolutionaries trying to fundamentally overthrow all currently existing institutions is the only real accountability we have is that which we can create with each other in real lived relationships.
You reached out to me because you've been listening to some of the podcasts I've done on this issue already. It wasn't like you were unhappy, but you didn't think it was perfectly covered. So I wanted to give you the opportunity to say what it was that motivated you to want to talk about this with me.
So. Right. I think that there are a lot of confusions about militant street politics, militant anti-fascism, and that are basically linked to the fact that the people who participate in militant street action are generally not very eager to talk about it in public fora. So the people who do talk about radical politics and militant anti-fascism or whatever it might be, Black Bloc and so on, the people who like to talk about those things in public are generally people who do not do them. And so that leads to, I think, a plethora of confusions and biases. And so at a certain point, you know, I hear certain sort of bromides and I'm sort of like, you know, it gets frustrating. I'm like, you know, I engage in militant anti-fascism. I can actually just tell you about it if you want me to, you know. So yeah. A few things that you hear in the media often, and even from very well-informed, you know, people on the left or the radical left even, there are a lot still of sort of confusions. And one of them is that Black Bloc or, you know, in particular, people talk about Black Bloc as if it's a movement. And sometimes you will often hear people literally refer to it as a movement. And it's not a movement. As far as I know, there does not exist any Black Bloc movement of sort of organized people whose, you know, main ideological commitment is to wearing all black and smashing shit up. That's not really a movement. Or if there is a movement of black blockers, I'm not aware of it. And I'm pretty actively immersed in these sorts of things. So I think I would have heard about it if it does exist. Black Bloc is a tactic. It's a thing that you can do depending on the circumstances, which may or may not be useful. So it's not a movement. You can think of militant anti-fascism as a movement. You can think about some other things as a movement, but Black Bloc itself is just a tactic. So another point that follows from this is that there are many reasons to use Black Bloc that are not just, you know, to smash up, you know, Starbucks glass windows, although that's one reason and, you know, might even be a good reason in sometimes in places. I'm not actually here to judge that. I don't believe in sort of disavowing, you know, the idea of a diversity of tactics is actually, you know, that you don't disavow the conscientious choices of comrades, right? So I'm not necessarily, I don't need to necessarily defend, you know, smashing windows or whatever it might be, but it is an important principle to not go out of your way to disavow it in principle. So that's what people talk about when they talk about sort of a diversity of tactics. What I wanted to talk about is that there are many reasons to use Black Bloc, right? So, and they're not, some of them are much more sort of understandable, I think, to normal people. One is just basic anonymity and privacy. What a lot of people who don't go to protests don't realize is that at any major protest in the wealthy liberal democracies today, there are loads of cops and some of them undercover, typically. And there will be a lot of people sort of taking notes, taking photographs, taking video, recording protesters just to collect information. So for the most part, in the wealthy liberal democracies, you can't go to a large scale protest in peace and in the public and express yourself in the public domain without having information about you collected quite aggressively by the police. OK, so if you want just the right to go to a protest and you don't want the police to have files on you, then it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do to put a mask on. OK, and you don't have to be a crazy nihilist, you know, property destroyer to want to block up for that reason. Another reason is solidarity with other people who might want to engage in more risky behaviors. Perhaps you don't even agree with it, but perhaps you understand that other people might get arrested for doing who knows what, maybe things that they deserve to get arrested for, maybe things that they don't deserve to get arrested for. You know that there are frequently unwarranted arrests that take place at protests, and perhaps you want to have solidarity with those people. And one way to have solidarity with those people is for you to all wear the same clothes and look the same so that you're essentially interchangeable. By wearing all black, what you're able to do with all the other people who wear all black is protect each other. So if one person does something that a police wants to sort of snag them for, well, if you're wearing the same thing as them, that person can run away and you can sort of, appear in that place in the mob. And the police can't distinguish you from the person who they were trying to arrest. So showing up in all black and blocking up, as they say, is a way of embodying, you know, a kind of solidaristic public presence with other people who may likely be targeted for, unjust arrests or whatever, it might be. Another reason is that, you know, and I think this doesn't get enough play because people who do this sort of thing are, you know, unfortunately, not always willing or eager to talk about it. But the simple experience of autonomous collective freedom is, a very important political value in and of itself. And the fact is that in our sort of pacified liberal democracies today, the average human being does not have any opportunity to engage in fundamentally rebellious, autonomous, collective protest against institutions in a truly free and collective way. You just don't have any opportunities to do that within our sort of controlled, pacified, fake democracies. And so it is a very legitimate reason for Black Bloc to simply have the empowerment and the psychological, personal and interpersonal experience of being more powerful than usual and being able to engage in different types of militancy and rebelliousness, up to and perhaps even including things like property destruction, simply for the experience of a feeling that is otherwise barred to human beings. And I'm not necessarily saying, you know, that people should, destroy property. I'm not necessarily justifying it. But like, as I said before, I'm also not disavowing it. All I'm really saying is that human beings need to be free. And if their societies have evolved in such a way that they're literally deprived of the most basic experience of collective autonomy in public, well, then I do think that people have to do what they need to do to have a taste of that experience. And in our societies, it often means things like Black Bloc and, taking those types of steps that you need to take to be able to have that sort of public presence. I do think that that's not, you know, some people will make fun of me for, you know, oh, okay, so you think you people should do it just because it's fun. Well, I would say, you know, a deep form of collective autonomous rebellious fun is actually super important. And yeah, I would be willing to defend that. Finally, another reason I want to talk about is that, you know, it's about the cultural politics of performing collective rebelliousness. So not just the sort of the empowerment and the psychological sort of experience that comes from this sort of radical way of being in public and acting with others in public. But it's actually a matter of working on the symbolic sphere, working on sort of cultural politics and the way people perceive it, right? So, you know, people cite, you know, people like, you know, Subcomandante Marcos from the Zapatistas, right, who famously said, "We wear masks to be seen," right? So this very nice little ironic phrase illustrates what I'm trying to talk about, which is that our societies today have become very good at making it look like everyone is basically on board for this sort of capitalist historical tendency that is sweeping everything away. It's very hard, right? This is sort of Marcuse and one-dimensional man, and this whole idea that basically contemporary capitalism is kind of collapsing all possible forms of opposition into it. And so if you take that seriously, you really want to think hard about ways that you can creatively go into the streets with your mates and convey or perform a certain kind of otherness, a certain kind of radicalism or militance, a certain kind of, you want to be able to go into the streets and say, I did not choose to belong to any of this. And in fact, I'm opposed to almost all of it. And what better way to sort of signal or convey the existence of that sort of opposition than by something so dramatic and, I think, to be perfectly honest, quite aesthetically beautiful and compelling about, you know, something such as wearing all black and going into the streets with a large group of people who together in that anonymity and that shared solidarity can do things that they normally wouldn't be able to do. And they're perceived in a way that they aren't normally perceived. I think that what it's doing is basically showing that antagonisms do exist, which in the everyday spectacle aren't usually allowed to arise. So that's sort of a long laundry list of reasons why Black Bloc can be a really good and useful and perfectly defensible tactic. That's not just about destroying property or, you know, these sorts of things that there's that Black Bloc is associated with.
Okay. Well, I think that's a great place to close out the first half of this conversation. So, but stay on the line.